Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So what I thought I would do is just to tell you guys sort of the story of this company, how we got started and built sort of our core technology and how the company has evolved over many, many years. You know Pandora as a radio service, but ten years ago when I first founded this company, we didn't actually intend to build a radio and spent a lot of years thinking that we were building a whole different kind of business model. And it wasn't until 2005, about 5 years after we founded the company, that we actually became a radio service. So I'll just sort of take you through that and try and sort of cover off a bunch of different sort of dimensions of this experience. And again, I know we have different backgrounds in the audience. Some folks are engineers, some are aspiring entrepreneurs, and if there are areas that any one of you has a particular interest in, you know, by all means, I'm happy to dive into it. So don't be shy. So let's see. Last time I was in Santa Barbara was with my band, actually. Mid-90s. We played a club on the main street. It was an audience much smaller than this we played to, if I remember right. But my life before this company was, I was a musician. I spent about 12 years after college playing in rock bands. I was a Stanford grad, graduated in 1988. And when I left school, I'd studied music. Political science was my actual major, which is Stanford's shortest major. So you can do a lot of other things and still get your degree, which was kind of my plan when I was an undergraduate. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of school, but I knew I wanted to stay involved with music. I had been playing piano since I was a little kid, and I had studied recording arts and had been writing music. And so when I graduated, I was sort of trying to figure out how I would make that sort of my vocation. The first actual job I got, my first paying job out of college, was a nanny. Actually, the proper term is manny. I took care of a couple of kids, a job that I actually held for about 5 years. And kids is my other sort of lifelong passion. And so my life for a number of years consisted of playing music from morning until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, going to pick up these two boys from their initially elementary school and eventually middle school, going home and hanging out on the street playing wiffle ball and all sorts of things, and then making dinner for the family and heading home and jumping back on the piano. And it was a good life. It's not what my parents expected when I got out of school, but it allowed me to really dive deeply into music, which I did. I practiced the piano 6-7 hours a day, and I was really getting very deeply engaged in what was at that time a very fast evolving sort of new wave of technology in the music space. So initially, principally focused around recording, sort of desktop recording, and then, of course, that evolved over the years into the web and all of that entails. I also began playing in bands and started touring, sort of played the Western United States, kind of Colorado West. And eventually that became sort of my principal activity, and I spent a lot of time on the road and really got a pretty deep education into the challenges, sort of the life of a working musician. And all working musicians face one very particular and difficult challenge, which is, you know, how do you build an audience? And very few artists have the opportunity to get on broadcast radio, which is obviously the principal form of promotion. So the only real mechanism available to you back then, in particular, was to get in a van and start driving around and build your audience, you know, a dozen people at a time, and hope that you could hang on long enough that the grassroots following you develop will sort of push you into the world of record labels and kind of the marketing support and the infrastructure of the music business. But of course, very, very few bands last that long, and, you know, very few make it to that level. Instead, you wind up, you know, 10, 12 years later, gradually bowing out of the career, which was what happened in my case. But it left me with a very strong sense of, one, the problem facing musicians, but also the amount of very talented artists that are around that we don't know about. I played on the stage with a lot of them. A handful of the bands I played with went on to do big things, but for the most part, all these bands eventually broke up, and no one really, it was like a tree falling in the forest. Nobody really knew about them. And so I've long had an interest in how do you solve that problem. The sort of second piece of my musical career was actually a film composer. So I spent about 5 years after playing in rock bands writing music for movies and commercials and whatnot. And the role of a film composer is essentially to figure out someone else's music taste. So you sit down with a director, typically, you've got a locked, finished picture in front of you, and you sit across a table from each other, each with a stack of CDs, and you start playing music for each other. And you get the director's feedback, kind of the thumb up, thumb down to the music. And the point being, as a composer, you kind of take that feedback and from that, figure out what they want. And they're not usually musicians, so they can't actually specify musicological characteristics. They can just say, I like that, or I don't like that, or that sounds funny, or, you know, that one I really like. And then it's your job to translate that into musicological information, so when you go back to the recording studio, you can actually translate that into a new composition. So I was doing this and developing kind of a pretty decent ability to figure out what people liked and kind of why they liked it, and was developing kind of a notion of a genome, a sort of musical genome in my brain. And living in the Bay Area, it was kind of late 1999, and I had the idea of if I could take this sort of musical map I was using in my profession and figure out some way to map it and sort of codify it into a taxonomy, there might be some interesting way to connect that with technology and then deliver it as a recommendation tool. So kind of automate the thing I was doing as a composer. So you could say, I like this song, and somehow this little machine could figure out the taxonomy and the musicological characteristics and connect it to other songs that were similar. And 99 was sort of the first big sort of apex of the dot-com bubble. So there was a lot of entrepreneurial activity, especially up in the Bay Area. And I shared the idea with a friend of mine. It was all this activity on the web. These music sites were popping up left and right, and it was this surge of excitement around digital music. And I said, hey, what do you think of this idea? And he said, that sounds cool. Let's make a company. And a week later, we wrote a business plan. And like within 3 weeks, I was about to move to L.A. For my film composing. I retracted an offer on a house. And we sat down and went out and raised money. And in March of 2000, we raised our first round of angel investment, $1.5 million of investment capital to start the company, and rented a one-room studio in San Francisco and started coding the technology. So I'll go forward a little bit, then I'll kind of come back to the actual technology. And I'm actually getting a little hot here, so hold on a second. Now you see how it's all done. Is that all right? Okay. It feels better. Can I get a glass of water or something? Is there some water somewhere? Started the company, $1.5 million in the bank, and began hiring some engineers and started building the core technology. It took us about close to a year to really build the beta version of this thing that we called the Music Genome Project. Which was this big musical taxonomy and a set of algorithms, some math wrapped around it, so we could have this demo where you would go to this little website, type in a song, and hit, you know, find similar songs, and it would bring back a list of songs. And after about a year of building that, we had this little demo, and it was working pretty well, but we had begun to run out of money. The company had grown to about 60 people. We had some software engineers, and we had a big group of musicians that were doing the musical analysis, which I'll talk to you about. And in mid-2001, we realized that we were going to be in deep trouble financially, so we began paying our employees a smaller and smaller percentage of their salaries, which we called salary deferral at the time. It's actually illegal in California to do that, as it turns out. Yeah. So if anybody asks you to work for free, know they're breaking the law. It was obviously pretty commonplace back at that time, because a lot of companies were running into the same trouble we had. But ultimately, we, by the end of 2001, we weren't paying anybody anything. And we went for almost, I guess, about 2.5 years without taking salary. There were a group of about 50 or 60 people who worked either full or part-time for that entire period without getting paid. So we were, you know, in full violation of California labor law for a long time there. But it allowed the company to obviously survive. And then finally, in 2004, we raised our first big round of financing and paid everybody back that were all owed this substantial amount of money. And at that time, we had built this technology. You have a question? Yeah.
How much were you able to carry the employees for? Like, how much salary, like, in about terms?
How much money do we owe?
Yeah.
We owed close to $2 million of salary. Yeah. It was kind of insane at the time. There's sort of an odd thing that happens, phenomenon when you get. I think it's a little bit like gambling. I don't gamble for this reason, but I imagine it's what it's like when you're at the gambling table and you've been there 6 or 7 hours, and all of a sudden you realize you're down a lot more than you thought, and you think, oh, you know what? I'll just play one more hand. You know, I'll just put my wristwatch in, and then I'll put my car, and then I'll, you know, before you know it, you've really committed yourself. Always thinking, I'm just going to get it back. I just got to go a little further. And there were a bunch of people that were kind of willing to sort of make that gambit. And I think after you spent a lot of time working on something, the last thing you want to do is kind of say, you know what, I just screwed up. I just spent 2 or 2.5 years, and I should have given up a long time ago. So there's, I think, a lot of motivation to actually make it right and stick to it. Fortunately, we had a great group of employees that were willing to do that. Stuck with us, and so we survived, because it's pretty inexpensive to run a company when you don't pay anybody. So we were able to squeak by on a pretty thin budget. Oh, thanks. That's great. And so in 2004, we raised about $9 million from a consortium of venture capitalists in the Bay Area. And we paid everybody back, sort of recapitalized the company. At that point, we had this big piece of intellectual property, which was the Music Genome Project, and a really cool-looking demo, but we had no business, really. We hadn't generated much in the way of revenue. We had a few paying customers for that as a technology, but we hadn't really figured out how to make a business out of it. So we had a big kind of revisioning. A few months after that, we raised that money, I hired a new CEO, a fellow named Joe Kennedy, who is our current CEO. And Joe kind of took the company through a big revisioning process, and at the end of it, we kind of realized that the way we should be using this technology was as a personalized radio service. So we completely kind of changed direction. We took the genome and repurposed it and built a website on top of it. In the fall of 2005, we sort of had our first beta version of it. In October of that, the first thing we did, actually, when we had the first working version of it, we gave access to a couple hundred of our closest friends and family, just to kind of kick the tires and give us some feedback on it, sort of a password-protected version of the site. Like a week or two later, there were 5,000 people that had access to it. And they weren't supposed to tell anybody about this this sort of private preview. So our most trusted friends and family clearly were excited enough about this product that they were spreading the word. And so we had this feeling, wow, there's something kind of exciting here. There's a real appetite for this. And so we quickly rolled it out and launched it as a public site in late October of 2005. Initially, we thought that Pandora was going to be a subscription business. So when we first launched, the deal was, as a listener, you could go to Pandora and get 10 hours of free listening, after which you'd be asked for a credit card. And you had to pay $3 a month for an annual subscription. And what happened is we had a lot of usage, and usage actually blew up pretty quickly, but nobody was paying for it. People would use it for a while and then get off and kind of reconfigure their computer, erase their cookies, and get back on and get 10 more free hours of listening. It was pretty clear to us that this sort of paid model wasn't going to work. So in November, we launched the free version, and the one that I presume most of you use here. And that just took off like a rocket ship. We have grown, we're about 36 million registered listeners now in the US, and we add about 65,000 new listeners a day. And it's all by word of mouth. So we've never advertised Pandora. It's grown entirely virally, which is a really exciting thing to be a part of. The amazing thing about the web these days is if you build something that catches the imagination of the internet users, it can grow awfully fast on its own. And we're finding that that's true for us. Yeah. So the original business model was we thought we would build this this database, have a set of software tools and API package on top of it, which we would license to other companies. So if you were a music retailer, you were selling music, you wanted a way to help people discover more of your catalog, we would kind of be the ingredients inside that. So you were going to buy a CD, this site would call the genome and say, hey, my customer's about to buy this CD, what else should they buy? I know the idea of buying CDs may sound quaint to all of you, but back then there was a lot of excitement about that still. And we'd sort of be a licensed business-to-business provider of discovery, sort of recommendation technology. As it turns out, we actually had some deals. So AOL and Best Buy and Borders and Tower Records, when they were still around, all licensed it, but they didn't pay very much money for it. So it turned out to be kind of a lousy business. And frankly, one of the things that really appealed to us about being a radio is we had our destiny in our own hands. So we weren't sort of subject to the vagaries of a partner who was using your technology, but if they didn't implement it properly or took too long, there's really nothing you could do about it. So launched 05 November, and it really did take off in a hurry. Big inflection point also happened about 2 years ago when we launched Pandora on the iPhone, and I'll give you some detail around that. Accelerate our growth pretty dramatically and also kind of reshaped our whole industry. We're now 160 employees. Our headquarters is in Oakland, but we have offices in a lot of cities around the US, primarily sales offices. And we're building sort of an advertising-supported radio product now. It's kind of our central thrust. So that's kind of the cliff notes of the last 5 years. Are there any questions about what I've talked about so far? So I'll dive into yeah. So do you want to use the microphone, I guess? Yeah.
When you collected the $9 million from the venture capitalists and $2 million of that was going to pay for stuff that already happened, yeah. How did you convince them to do that when a lot of it was going to pay stuff that already occurred?
That's a really good question. It's very rare for investors to solve problems of the past. Typically, a new investor comes in, especially when your company is under duress, which is would be a wild understatement for us. They generally have all the leverage, and they want their money to be used for the company they're going to build. And essentially, we had made a promise to our employees, which was if we ever raise above a certain amount of money, you're going to get paid. And it was kind of a pact. And so we said to the investors, we're not going to do this unless you're willing. And we're able to convince them that the company actually had enough promise that they sort of overcame their own reservations about it. And I think it was actually a really, I think it was a smart move, a pretty bold move on the part of the investors, but they decided it was worth it. And I think that part of what they were investing in was the tenacity of the company, you know, that they liked that we had survived. And so that was kind of the price tag for that, I think. And it was, you know, it was a, money hit the bank, and I hadn't actually told anybody in the company we had raised it until the wire had arrived, because we had so many close calls over the years. The pitch that led to this funding was my 348th venture pitch in those dry years. I actually went back and counted one time. In one of my particularly low moments. I've lost my train of thought. What was I going to say?
Talking about telling your employees.
Yes, I'm sorry, thanks. As these months wore on, every couple of weeks we would have an all-hands meeting. And generally the topic of the all-hands meeting was, can you please work 2 more weeks for nothing? And there are fairly depressing events that we had month after month after month. And this was another typical all-hands meeting, only this time when everybody sat down, I pulled out literally this huge wad of envelopes from my pocket with paychecks for everybody for, you know, in some cases, you know, six-figure numbers. And that was a pretty good moment. Which I'll never soon forget. It was good. But I think it was a good move by investors. It's unusual, but heck, it's going to pay off for them, you know? So more power to them.
I was curious about that.
I guess the initial... Okay. The initial partnering. So you're not coming from like a software development side or anything like that. And was that your initial partner or was... I guess, how did you overcome that technological hurdle of that not being your background?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Founding teams is a really key piece of building a business, and I had two founders, you know, co-founders. One was a college classmate of mine whose background was really kind of business management, and he had actually already successfully started and sold a software company. Wasn't a software programmer, had sort of a modest amount of knowledge of computer programming, but was really a businessman. And he was a founding CEO of the company. The second co-founder was a technologist. He was a computer scientist and mathematician. So he was the founding technology piece of the business. He hired all the software engineers. He was the one who sort of built the mathematical algorithms and sort of helped marry the technical piece to the musicological piece, which was my responsibility. He's actually a really unusual guy. His name is Will Glazer. He's a Cornell graduate, and he was a triple major in math, computer science, and physics in college. And he was in the top of his class in all three of those. And so unusual guy, Nobel laureate, astrophysicist father. And fabulously bright, but also a really unusual in that the kind of thinker who can work conceptually on things, not just sort of a very narrow, too far in the weeds guy, but someone who kind of abstract out of problems and solve things. And he spent a few, I guess 3 or 4 months we got to get all the smartest people we all knew, programmers and mathematicians to talk about this algorithm. Because it had to be a pretty unique algorithm. It had to work really fast and compute a tremendous load of calculations really quickly. And this group met for months and months, and then one afternoon, Will would sort of listen in, not contribute too much. And after a few months, like one afternoon, I remember he said, I think I've got it. And the next morning, there it was. And it's been more or less the same algorithm that he originally created. So one of the things I would advise anybody who's starting a company is, you know, find someone around who's smarter than you and more competent than you and bring them on board. You do well when you do that.
I have a question about when you starting to switch your business model. Mm-hmm. So one important thing I can imagine is how to license those music. Mm-hmm. That's a very challenging task, especially for a small company like Pandora at that time. How to negotiate with those big brand companies and have them willing to put the music on your website?
Sure. So licensing is a huge issue for online services, for sure. And fortunately for us, in the world of webcasting, there exists an actual federal statute, so a piece of federal legislation called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that's called a statutory or compulsory agreement that gives Pandora the permission, by virtue of its place in federal law, to play anything that we want to play without any direct agreements with rights holders. So Pandora has no, quote, kind of label deals. We have no direct agreements. We operate under a federal statutory license. And in fact, any one of you could this afternoon start a web radio, and all you'd need to do is sign this one piece of paper, and you could be doing it entirely legally. It comes with some caveats. So you have to pay performance fees. It actually requires you pay royalties to artists. It also limits the amount of interactivity you can have on your station. So you can't do things like play a song on demand on Pandora. You can't type in a song and hear it right away, because that would be a violation of this statutory license for webcasting. But the beauty of it is that we don't have to negotiate individual agreements with what would be tens of thousands. We have 80,000 artists in our collection now. We have to get each one of them to agree to let us use their music. And that's just completely untenable. Fortunately, there's a solution to it. Yeah.
Well, I have an unusual question. I didn't know if you were one of the founders, but I have my master's from engineering, and I'm not as young as all of you. And I've had NIH funding to create an online community in the area of e-health games. I'm looking for young people to join in, like your employees did as well. But I've thought, because I'm a woman and I'm a little older and other issues, that I should get a CEO. You know, maybe I need a 30-year-old guy to be my CEO. But I've had reservations about that as well. Like, you know, they don't bring money. Why should I let them be the CEO? But you said you hired a CEO. So I was just wondering about your feeling if you're starting a company and you feel like there's some things that investors might look at in a negative sense. Would you hire a CEO, and what advantages for you would be for a founder to actually bring in a CEO?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, because you're older, whatever that means, and a woman, has absolutely no bearing whether you should have a CEO or not. I mean, let's get that off the table first. To me, I think when you think about a founding team, the way to think about it is, what functions does your company most rely on? What are the things that do you have to really get right in order to make the company work? These days, typically, there's a technology piece to that, because it sounds like the project you're considering is very much of a web idea. So it would make sense, probably, to have somebody in your core group, sort of a significant owner of the company, who is a technologist of some kind. The CEO, in the early going, titles are somewhat arbitrary, you know, in a company. But I think the CEO title winds up going to the person who is the most logical leader of the company. So who is the person who's going to get up at the all-hands meetings and motivate the employees? Who's going to be the kind of person to give the presentation to the investors? Who is kind of the natural-born leader of the company? And I didn't start off as that. And probably when I started this company, I hadn't really done it before. John, my co-founder, had. I grew into that role and eventually became the CEO over a number of years, once I had developed those capabilities and had confidence that I could do it. But it was really sort of more the titles were driven by the natural roles in the company. I do think that you should not do this alone. I really think you're well advised to get at least one other person, if not two, because it's nice to have a tiebreaker when you're trying to make a decision. Three substantial and potentially equal owners of the company. And you've got to pick wisely. You've got to pick people who you trust, like a sibling, assume you trust your siblings, and who brings a set of capabilities that you don't have, and is, you know, tremendously talented, and give them ownership and say, you are part of my family, my cabinet here. I'm giving you a big chunk of ownership in the company, kind of giving you that respect, and then giving them the sort of latitude to be a real important strategic and operational partner. In my case, for Joe, the CEO, what happened was when 2004 rolled around, I was actually kind of tired of being the CEO. I had done all the things a CEO does. My personal passion is not so much for the day-to-day operations of a company, the sort of ins and outs of running a business, the preparation of board books and the balancing of spreadsheets and setting out projections and all those things. All really important, but not what I love to do and nor what I was really good at. My talents lay much more in sort of the strategy, the music side, and the sort of outward-facing piece. So when 2004 rolled around, I knew I would like to have somebody come in and play that role. And with the luxury of financing, we could. And the investors wanted that too. So there was sort of a tacit agreement between all of us that post-financing we'd bring somebody in. And it's worked out like a charm, which it doesn't usually do, actually. Very few founders survive multiple funding rounds in a startup because the company changes, their skill sets tend to become more and more obsolete. They're kind of dreamer types, you know, or they're a little less. They're not as happy in larger organizations. They don't love having a boss, those kind of things. And so they typically leave after later stages. But the nice thing for us is that Joe and I occupy two very different roles and very complementary roles in the company. There's actually a Harvard Biz School case study on the two of us about founder transition. I have sort of two principal roles internally with strategy. So I'm involved in the company's direction and vision and at a macro level. And then I spend a lot of my time externally facing. So a lot of press, a lot of public talking, a lot of evangelism. I'm out with the ad sales teams, kind of being Pandora's ambassador, which is a full-time job. Yeah.
Hello. Speaking of strategy, do you ever anticipate any kind of copycat intelligent radio sites? I'm thinking about other technology-driven sites like Friendster and MySpace being kind of toppled by Facebook, or now Bing is competing with Google. So do you think of any consequences of being at the top? And also, do you share any of your algorithms with other user-based preference sites like Genie or anything like that?
Oh, the Genius, Apple Genius?
It's the film one. It's like a kind of intelligent film. It's J-I-N-N-I.
Oh, I don't know about that. So the short answer is we always keep our eyes out for competition. And there are competing companies that use different methodologies to solve the same problem. Generally, they used math, just straight-up statistics, what's commonly called collaborative filtering, where you get a lot of user information, you start mining that to look for patterns and build playlists and recommendations based on, you know, how one user compares to another. And that's kind of the state of the art for most services doing this. There's a whole world of what's called machine listening, which is using computers to do digital signal processing and extract this metadata from sound files. We watch that very carefully and have yet to see something come out of there that we think is really valuable. There actually is an exact replica of Pandora in China. And if you go to it, it looks exactly like Pandora. Literally, it's a copy. And it's in Chinese. It's completely unlicensed, although they did send us a letter saying, thank you for giving us permission to use Pandora in China, which we never did. So I would anticipate that people will emulate the things that we do that work. It's happening in our advertising product. You see the things we do often get copied by other sites. But the beauty of the underlying technology is it's really hard to replicate. Let me just show that, actually, now that you brought that up. So this is what our office looks like, or at least part of it. These are the music analysts at Pandora whose job is to come in every day and analyze music. And what they do, they slap on a pair of headphones and they listen to songs and they literally score every song along about 400 attributes per song manually. So they enter numbers that correspond to all the kind of granular details of a piece of music, everything about melody and harmony and form and rhythm and vocal performance, etc. They capture it in this big list of numbers. And this actually, here, this is a slide, Bill. You're not going to be able to read this. That's not intentional. But this is one of 7 pages. I'm sorry, it's probably not legible, a shaking like this. But each one of these attributes is a piece of musicological detail that's assigned a number by an analyst. They manually enter them, about 400 of them, up to 400 per song. So when they're done with this analysis, they have sort of the equivalent of musical DNA for every song. When you type a song into Pandora, what happens is it actually calculates the musical proximity of one song to another based on these numbers. Kind of nearest neighbor analysis for you mathematicians. That's where the algorithm comes in. And so from the standpoint of competitive pressures, This is very hard to replicate. We've been doing this for 10 years. We have 700,000 songs now that have been analyzed, and it takes anywhere from 15 minutes to 2 hours to do a single piece of music. So this is actually the slide that got me kicked out of most of my venture pitches back in the early years of the company because, you know, it's crazy. It's not very scalable, and you have to hire human beings to do it and pay them. And keep them happy, manage them, not like computers. And so it's kind of a ridiculous approach, but now it represents a huge barrier to another company coming along and doing the same thing. The second part of your question was, we don't license it to other people anymore. So we're not, any of the sites you see out there, they're not using our tools.
I wanted to ask, given all the huge changes that have happened in the music industry in the last 5 to 10 years, and Pandora being a very big part of that, how much do you think that's changed the environment for musicians, for the better, for the worse, and where do you think it's going now?
That's a big question. I think overall it's changing it for the better. I think we're going through a time where it's of disintegration, of collapse, of kind of, you know, smashing everything and then having to build it back up again. But I think on the other side of this, what's a pretty painful transition is going to be a new music industry that I think is much more open to musicians, much more empowering of musicians, and has room for a lot more of them. To use sort of Pandora as an example, and we're one of many, so we have 80,000 artists on our website that play on stations. 70% of those artists are independent. So these are folks who have never been played on radio before. And of the 700,000 songs in our collection, 90% played last month on stations. So it's giving access now to tens of thousands of musicians who have been essentially invisible for a long time. And that radio has long been the cornerstone of a musician's career. It's the way people discover you. And the beauty of the web, of course, is that if you like a piece of music while you're listening to it on the web, you can immediately do something about it. You can buy it, you can, you know, research it, you can bookmark it, you can share it with someone, etc. So the potential of radio, this kind of radio, to amplify its value for musicians is really enormous. And what I think we're going to see in the coming years is this growing new class of musicians who are utilizing sites like ours and like many others out there who are offering tools and sort of different pieces of the puzzle to build sustainable careers and have something that'll look more like a musician's middle class than this kind of feast or famine business that it is right now. So I would love to be graduating from college right now with my band and getting ready to dive into this new world, where before it was, you know, thousands of musicians trying to squeeze into this narrow little gap that only allows a trickle of artists through to succeed. So I'm very optimistic about it. Yeah.
So you said that the Federal Digital Millennium Act, I think that's what it was called, you can't just like type in a song and it shows up, right? It has to be like a radio.
That's
well,
right.
In Pandora, can you, to start off, don't you type in a song and you start off there?
You do type in a song, but that song doesn't play right away. That song is your starting point musicologically, so it's the reference point for the songs we choose, but that actual song itself, we can't play in any predictable fashion on the station, because that would violate the spirit of it's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So, difference between seeding a station and playing it right away.
Okay, and also, what is your advertising strategy?
Got some slides on that too. Let's jump to that. Let's slide through some of the stuff here. I'll get back to these pictures. Okay. So, Pandora is supported through visual advertising principally right now, though we're starting to add more and more audio advertising on the service. And it's a pretty straightforward business model. So, this is the tuner. And all of the real estate that wraps around this is kind of our canvas for doing advertising. So we sell this space on Pandora to all sorts of advertisers, film studios, car companies, liquor companies, you know, fast food chains, you name it. And these ads appear when somebody interacts with the service. So one of the historical problems with radio online and monetization of it is that people would typically launch this internet radio and then they would minimize it while they do something else, which probably was what most of you do. Problem with that, of course, is you're not looking at it, so if we put up an ad, it's not worth anything to anybody. But we learned when people, and that was actually one of the reasons we launched as a subscription service, because we thought people are going to have to pay for this as a monthly subscription because we're not going to be able to deliver ads on it. What we found out, though, is that an average Pandora listener clicks on the site about 7 times an hour to do something, to skip a song or thumb a song up or down. We have something like 3.5 billion thumb feedbacks so far on Pandora. You guys love thumbing stuff, which is great. It makes your station better. And so because you're rewarded for doing it, you do it over and over. You go back to it and start this habit of interacting with it. That generates these impressions on the website, which we sell. And so we need to sell enough of these at a high enough price to pay for the service. And that's kind of the underlying economics of the business. We'll do about $40 million of revenue this year through advertising. We're beginning to do some audio, little 10 to 15 second audio interstitials and some video as well, but it's really, so far, but the lion's share has been the visual stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you were initially starting to promote the website, I know you said that most of the promotion was viral, so like it was kind of just, you know, momentum-wise. Did you ever use any like of the modern day like web marketing technique, like SEOs, SMOs, web content, or the spider, you know, search engine optimization stuff?
Yeah, we did use a little bit of search engine marketing in the beginning. I think maybe the first year we used some of that, but then turned it off. So it was a good little additional catalyst. But it never accounted for much more than 10 or 15% of our users, even when we were kind of full throttle.
Is there any, like, can you trace a reason for that in any way, or?
A reason for?
Like the SEO is not being as effective for your business model as opposed to, let's say, some other website that we're trying to, you know, promote to the top of Google.
Well, it wasn't so much that it wasn't effective. It actually was effective. It's that it cost money, and we had this free alternative. So let's just save our cash and let you guys do it for us. Was a much better strategic choice for us. And we were growing kind of as fast as we wanted to be honest. One of the things about this business is that every incremental hour of the service costs us more money because we pay licensing fees for everything. And so there's a point at which you grow too fast because each hour adds more cost and your advertising revenue takes a little while to catch up to it. So if this upline of growth gets steeper and steeper, you're really kind of racing to get your company in the black. So it was actually worked out kind of naturally and the way we wanted to without needing the SEM.
Just in your professional opinion, would you recommend using any web marketing techniques for another type of website? I know this one's very effective, but I'm going to assume that most other websites
Absolutely. I think search engine marketing is a fabulous tool. And the great thing about it is you can measure it. So you know exactly who comes and how much it costs per new customer. And you can say it's either worth it or not. You know, typically what a business will do is they'll determine how much any given customer is worth. So if you're a site that sells shoes and you know that the average person who visits your site buys, you know, $6.50 worth of shoes, then you can pay $6.49 to get them. I mean, you won't pay a lot less than that. But you can spend X amount of dollars to get them and you just make a simple calculation. And it's, you know, it's a effective and efficient way to get, I think, customers. I highly recommend it. Yeah.
So you said that you have 700,000 songs rated and like people doing it manually. So what is your answer to scalability? And do you plan to have like all the songs covered? And
well, the answer to our scalability is in the answer to your last comment, which is no, we don't. We don't expect to have all music. And we don't look at this as an exhaustive collection. We consider it a curated collection, like a museum. You know, we're trying to find what we think are the best tracks in history and going forward. And I'm beginning to think that that's about 10% of music. And you look at our collection, 700,000, iTunes, 8, 9, 10 million, something like that. We do 10,000 new songs a month. And a long time ago, the size of our catalog stopped being a problem from the standpoint of a user, I think. Less than 0.5% of the searches on Pandora are missed. So all the searches you guys start with, artists, songs, composers, less than 0.5% are things we don't have. And the beauty of this kind of a web, the web, is that we can watch that. So we know what we are missing. If you guys start searching for something, start showing up on our lists, we know we should go get it. And so you're sort of our like advanced team. And we just got to keep up with the things you tell us we're missing. And it's actually a relatively small amount of music. Because the reality is, and I say this as a musician, and I think it's great that anybody's making music and putting it out there, the truth is only a small amount of it is actually very good or is ready for commercial consumption. And that's kind of why it was the original premise of this whole approach. That's why we didn't worry too much about how long it took. And I think it's actually in the interest of a consumer. You guys would not like it if we had 7 million songs and they were all playing on Pandora. You'd be like, a lot, you know? So we do it for you.
And the second part question is, how does an artist come onto Pandora? Not like a big artist, but those 10,000, those like smaller artists you talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we get a lot of music sent to us. There's no prerequisite for inclusion. It just has to be good. So you could make something in your dorm room and send it in, and if it's good, we'll put it on Pandora. And a lot of the music we get would come to us without even a UPC code. It was like a blank CD-ROM with track titles written in Sharpie on the CD, and we have music like that in the collection. We've now recently instituted one requirement, which is your music has to be available for sale on Amazon. So it's the first time we've actually had there is actually another requirement. Anybody can do that. It costs $35 a year. But there's not you don't have to, be on a label or be good looking or be young or, none of those things matter. Yeah.
So along with the scalability issue, so I can imagine that this can be a big problem when you go international. So do you have any plan to expand this to international-wise? So
it's one of our great frustrations right now that we're not available outside the U.S. We're not allowed to stream to a listener that's sitting in another country, and the reason it has to do with licensing. There's no equivalent license that we have in the U.S. anywhere else in the world. We actually, for the first year of Pandora, you could access it from overseas or outside the U.S. just by pretending you were a U.S. resident and typing in a U.S. zip code for the first year. Our most popular zip code in the first year was 90210 on Pandora. It's true. After a year, we had to start blocking using IP addresses. That doesn't prohibit us from playing music from outside the country to U.S. listeners, though. So we do have Spanish and Portuguese language music. We're getting ready to launch Asian Indian music into Pandora. We're working on stuff from Africa. We fully intend to have a collection, a global collection, even if we wind up stuck in the U.S. for a while. We're going to keep working at it to get licenses to open up everywhere else, but our catalog will extend. It does present some additional challenges for the music analysis operation, but I think they are surmountable, and we'll likely probably open up, and at least in East Asia, we'll probably have an office of analysts out there. That's one kind of musical culture that I think requires some endemic, knowledge. But the folks at Pandora right now are analyzing Indian ragas. A well-trained musician with the methodology that we use can actually do a very broad range of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just curious of whether you had music videos for people.
Not really. Videos play a very small role on Pandora. We found that people come to Pandora to listen, and the more we throw things in front of them that are, hey, check this out, they don't really go there, and it winds up being kind of a visual distraction on the page. So we kind of stick to our knitting. Yeah.
Tim Westergren, on behalf of the Technology Management Program, thank you for joining us in Santa Barbara today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.